The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, we'll look at the growing number of government leaders in the U.S. who have gotten too friendly with China.
Democrats see it to their advantage to provide cover on multiple levels that are compromised.
It gets worse. China expert Gordon Chang weighs in.
The Democratic Party right now has a China problem. They're supporting China over American interests.
The special election for the Senate that will set the course for the nation in the next Congress is set for January 5th in Georgia.
We beat them last time with all the shenanigans that we think could have happened. We beat them then. We're going to beat them again.
And miraculously, COVID vaccinations are already beginning to roll out. One medical officer urges informed consent.
And in my opinion, we should never mandate this vaccine.
I'm Mark Davis in for Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my show each weekday morning, 7 to 10 a.m. live Central Time, on demand at 660amtheanswer.com. And follow me on Twitter at Mark Davis. Follow this program always at Town Hall Review. Let's start with China. As things start quieting down following one of the most rancorous elections in recent history, the threats from China are increasing. But the most recent of these threats aren't in the military vein. Seems that some high-level elected officials, our president-elect included, have gotten a bit too cozy with the Chinese. The most startling example comes from four-term California congressman who's been implicated in a years-long romantic relationship with a known Chinese female spy. It's like a bad novel. This woman has been known to have had liaisons with other officials. No question, Representative Eric Swalwell, who sits on the House Intelligence Committee, was a prize for the Chinese. Colonel Kurt Schlichter, a retired Army colonel and one of my great friends sitting in this week for Hugh Hewitt, Kurt turned to New York Congressman Lee Zeldin.
Am I correct in saying you've been promoted to lieutenant colonel in the United States Army Reserve?
I have, yeah. No, it's a true honor to continue to serve. My background has been more military than it has been serving in Congress.
You understand about counterintelligence and spy threats. And, you know, in the House of Representatives right now, we've got Eric Swalwell, the pungent representative from California, and he fell into a honey trap, and he's still on the House Select Intelligence Committee. How did that happen?
Well, that's filled with questions that people are asking in search of answers. And the first attempt that you'll see, the first round of answers that are going to come from House Democrats are going to be an attempt to dodge, to get past the story, hope it goes away, and you move on to other stuff. I don't see that happening here, and the questions have followed. You almost are starting to see that second wave of questions to Speaker Pelosi, for example, and what you start finding if you're, say, communications director for the Speaker of the House, you say, hey, listen, Madam Speaker, this isn't going to work. We're going to have to actually answer the question. Every single member of Congress is a target for foreign countries. And especially if you serve on the House Intelligence Committee, you are a prime target because of your expanded access to some of our government's biggest secrets. So this is a serious issue beyond just a day's news cycle of something to talk about.
Well, you know, Representative Lee Zeldin, I'm just, you know, look, Eric Swalwell ran for president unsuccessfully. I think he did even worse than noted furry Beto. And, you know, I got to say, he's the kind of guy who's dumb enough to think this Beijing bimbo was after him for his mind and his achievements. How do we get the Democrats to take the threat of China seriously? Because obviously guys like Swalwell aren't, and Nancy Pelosi isn't.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I think on multiple levels, they're compromised as it relates to China. One is you have the historical status quo way of thinking. So some are just ingrained in continuing to think the way that they've always think, they've always thought for years or decades of their service. So that's one issue. Two is you see individuals who get compromised. You know, Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, the Biden family, you start to make business dealing decisions and you get compromised at that next level. And then third is they see it, you know, well, we're just going through and coming off of a rough experience for our country as it relates to coronavirus. I mean, that started in China. And when you have this desire to resist, oppose, impeach, and obstruct President Trump and anyone associated with him with regards to everything and anything, you start to provide cover to China because you're afraid that if you go after China, then somehow you can't blame President Trump for coronavirus as much as you want to. So that third piece is the political calculation where Democrats see it to their advantage to provide cover. So on multiple levels, they're compromised.
When it comes to our vulnerabilities toward China and the Chinese Communist Party, there's no one more accomplished than Gordon Chang. He's published several books, most recently The Great U.S.-China Tech War. He was the guest of my Salem colleague in New York City, Kevin McCullough, from AM 970, The Answer.
It just seems like China is everywhere. They're connected to everyone, particularly in the Democratic Party. And if the strategy against Swalwell is typical of how it's carried out, I spoke with former National Security Advisor Rick Grenell this week, and it seems like they have this send them into the college and then like align themselves with local politicians and follow them through their career strategy being executed all over the country. Gordon, is it true?
Well, it certainly is true. And as you point out, the most striking thing about China's approach toward Eric Swalwell was not that it started when he was on the House Intel Committee, which,
right,
of course, would be important for him, but it started when he was a council member in Dublin City, California. So China has identified politicians all across the U.S. and, you know, helps them, influences them, corrupts them, infiltrates them, whatever. And so this really shows that China's approach to the United States is comprehensive across the board, because it's not somebody like a council member from a locality in California. It was also the son of the then sitting Vice President Hunter Biden. So this is across the board.
They're going to make a serious play at crippling us if Joe Biden is the president-elect, are they not?
Well, whoever is going to be president sworn in as president on January 20, they're going to make a play for us. And the reason is that China seeks to overthrow the government of the U.S. They tried that this year, for instance, by inciting violence on American streets. They did that out of the Houston consulate, according to Radio Free Asia. And we know that Chinese leader Xi Jinping believes that China's the world's only sovereign state, which means we're a minor outpost on the world, being in North America, owing allegiance to China. So when we look at all of this, just China demands subservience from us, and they are not only trying to subvert us, they're actually committing acts of war against us, which is, for instance, inciting violence on our streets.
Well, Gordon, let's talk about what that looks from a practical policy standpoint. If the Democrats hold the Senate, the House, and the presidency, and you've got large swaths of the Democratic Party that are compromised, it's going to be free reign, is it not?
It is, and it's also the compromised Republicans as well. My sense is that the Democratic Party right now has a China problem. They're supporting China over American interests. I think large part of that is because they are just opposed to Trump. And so Trump was protecting the U.S., so the Democrats just opposed him automatically. When they are governing, when they're in the White House, I think that they're going to have to take a different attitude towards this, because the American people are going to demand it. And the American people are going to demand it because people like you, Kevin, are going to be raising this issue day in, day out because of China's malicious attacks on us. And that's why it's so important right now that with a sort of a China-friendly Biden or a China-compromised Biden or whatever, the American people have really got to defend their own homes, and you're going to be absolutely essential part of that.
Another worrisome story for conservatives in the wake of the November election is this runoff coming up for the two, count them two, Senate seats in Georgia. If both incumbents are unseated, we're talking David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, the impact on the direction of the nation will be grave. My Salem colleague Mike Gallagher was broadcasting from Georgia, and he spoke with Senator David Perdue on The Mike Gallagher Show.
You know, David Perdue's story is such an inspirational one. He's very much sort of like the outsider status that Donald Trump had in 2016. Prior to his big win in the U.S. Senate in 2014, Senator Perdue had never held public office. This is a guy who's been enormously successful in the private sector and became an incredibly popular U.S. senator with no prior political experience. It's a great, great story.
I appreciate you coming to Georgia this week to focus some light on this race. I mean, this is we are the last line of defense. Kelly Loeffler and I know what's at stake. We're out here working 24 hours a day. We're not going to leave any stone unturned. Believe me, we know what's at stake, and we're going to stand up to this leftist propaganda agenda that these guys are trying to perpetrate on our country.
The challenge for John Ossoff is to sort of pretend he's a moderate.
Well, of course, that's what all the Democrats are doing. Look at what Joe Biden did. They managed to pull it off a little bit. We'll see how that works out. But, you know, in a debate last Sunday night, Mike, you know, we've already had two debates, and we've listened to him lie to the people of Georgia now for the whole campaign. So we decided to give him a microphone and just let him know. And we heard him say he wants a total lockdown. He wants total amnesty. And he said he couldn't, when he was asked a question about how to help people in Georgia get through this virus, he said, well, I don't think we should get bogged down in the details. The people of Georgia are beginning to see what a shallow person this is. And I'm sorry, that's just not the way it works.
He's also a failed politician. I mean, he's tried. A lot of people didn't realize that John Ossoff has been down this path before, and the Georgia voters have said no to him.
Well, he ran against Karen Handel in a special election in 2017 and got beat, a 29-year-old. Before Georgia rejected him then, they rejected him in November. We beat him by 2 points, Mike.
Right.
In every other state except one, I would already have been reelected. We just have this 50% plus one rule. That's why we have to do this again. We'll beat him again. You know, he's the only guy I know that can debate an empty podium where the podium will win. I mean, it's just amazing. He just doesn't have much to say.
And you know, Senator Perdue, what people are saying all over the country, and certainly Georgians are saying it too, they're worried about election integrity. That's why there has to be a massive turnout.
We beat him last time with all the shenanigans that we think could have happened. We beat him then. We're going to beat him again. But here's what we're doing now. I mean, we've gone to the state authorities. As a federal officer, I have no control over what happens in the state.
Right.
So we're now taking our legal recourse. We filed a suit. We support the president's Texas suit. And we're hopeful that we will get some recourse here.
Coming up.
And in my opinion, we should never mandate this vaccine.
The coronavirus vaccine rolls out when the Town Hall Review returns in just a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. I'm Mark Davis in for Hugh this week. When the coronavirus hit our shores last winter, one of the first major initiatives launched by President Trump was Operation Warp Speed. The initiative funded several pharmacological firms to develop a vaccine against the virus and to do it by the end of the year. Critics on the left mocked the president. The elite media was derisive. Vaccine by year's end, it could take up to 5 years, they all crowed. The vaccine from the Pfizer Corporation was first out. The FDA issued its first emergency use approval last week. And my colleague Larry Elder turned to Dr. Jeffrey Barkey, a physician in Orange County, California, and he is co-founder of Personal Care Physicians Group in Newport Beach.
Do you credit President Trump with how quickly this vaccine has rolled out?
Oh, 100%. I mean, keep in mind, in years past, it would take many years of research and animal testing and human testing, et cetera, to bring a new vaccine or, for that matter, a medication to market. Not unusual for it to take 3 to 5 to 8 years to do that. And here we are what are we, 8 or 10 months in, and we've got a vaccine that's rolling as we speak.
Dr. Barkey, the safety and efficacy of the vaccine is supposed to be off the chart. Why is it so effective?
Well, we don't know. You know, this has only been tested now over the last 8 to 10 months. Mm-hmm. And what's really important, Sage, is to remember that this is an investigational vaccine that was given emergency use authorization by the FDA just last week. So it is an investigational vaccine. So we need to approach this with great optimism for its safety and efficacy. But at the same time, we need to be cautious about it. Remember, just last week, we heard about two patients in England that got the vaccination and had life-threatening allergic reactions to it, which prompted Pfizer to come out and say, we didn't see that in the studies, mm-hmm. but we're now recommending that if you have a history of severe allergic reactions, that you ought not take the vaccination. So we need to use caution, and we need to be optimistic, and we're hopeful that this will be a great success.
Doctor, would you take it?
Well, here's the deal. So first of all, we need to look at risk stratification and age group. So I'm in an age group where the survival, if I get this vaccination, is very, very high. And so you need to balance that with the potential downside and risks of the COVID vaccination. Or so me personally, no, I likely won't take it. But if somebody is at a very high risk, older, significant underlying conditions where the survivability is much lower if you get the virus, then those are the folks that I think should be considered to get the vaccination, but only with informed consent. And in my opinion, we should never mandate this vaccine. We haven't had a great history of vaccinations in this country, and there's some issues that should be considered. I mean, remember swine flu in 1976. We attempted a mass vaccination campaign only to realize we were harming a lot of people as they came down with Guillain-Barré syndrome, a very rare neurologic condition, and the vaccine was quickly pulled from the market as the expected pandemic never materialized. So we need to be very careful and very cautious as we move forward, carefully studying it, risk stratifying those that may get the vaccination. And certainly if you're in a young age group, so for example, less than 20, where the survivability of this virus is 99.997%, you know, you think twice about whether you want a new vaccination with limited testing in a group that has a very high survival rate.
So, doctor, who should take it? Who should be first in line?
The ones who should be first in line or should consider taking it are those that are in a very high risk group. So somebody that's 70 or 75, those that have significant underlying conditions where if they get the virus, they might be harmed. Those are the folks that should be getting it first. In our local area, it's going to be folks in nursing homes and frontline healthcare workers that are going to be offered this vaccination. My concern is there's going to be such excitement by the vaccination that the government and others are going to want to mandate this, and I'm entirely against that.
To hear Larry's complete conversation with Dr. Barkey, go to townhallreview.com. Amid these celebrations for the vaccine rollout, we watch with some regret as the Trump administration also begins to roll out, like roll out of town, as President-elect Biden begins to fill out some key roles. John Kerry, Secretary of State in the Obama administration, he's back, but not in the same role. Bob France turned to White House historian and author Tevi Troy. Bob's my good colleague at AM 1420 The Answer in Cleveland.
What a great article you wrote. I mean, the comparison that you made between the John Kerry-Tony Blinken potential relationship here in the Secretary of State's office, with John Kerry being kind of, you know, positioned as potentially being more powerful with cabinet-level powers than Blinken as Secretary of State. The comparison to the Eisenhower administration is simply remarkable. I'm going to let you kind of give us the thumbnail sketch of that, and then we'll follow up.
I saw this Kerry-Blinken relationship that they're talking about, mm-hmm. that you had in the 1950s. Eisenhower wasn't happy with the direction of disarmament policy, which is kind of like, I guess, maybe the climate policy of the day. I mean, it was the number one issue in the Republican Party, just like climate is the big issue in the Democrat Party. And he, Eisenhower, said, well, John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State's not working fast enough. Let me bring in Harold Stassen, who many of us now know as this guy who ran for president too many times, but at the time, Harold Stassen was this young, up-and-coming guy who had just been governor of Minnesota, was very talented, and he said, let's bring this guy in, make him the lead negotiator on climate, give him cabinet rank, And the New York Times loved this, and they called him the Secretary for Peace, which really irked Foster Dulles, who said, what does that make me, the Secretary for War? So these guys were poised to fight from minute one, and it sounded very similar to the way that the Kerry Blinken relationship is set up today.
Yeah, now, and as you point out in the article, this did not end well, really, for either guy, but you know, in the end, Dulles, you know, ends up prevailing. Tell us, you know, by the way, you mistakenly said climate, because it is a great analogy. You said climate when you meant to say disarmament in this particular case, but it is a great analogy here. John Kerry is being given the, I don't know, what would we call him, the Secretary for climate change or climate regulation or whatever, and what does that mean if he is enabled, or if he is empowered, rather, to negotiate with foreign countries as it pertains to Paris Climate Accords, et cetera, et cetera? Does he have to get clearance from Blinken, who is the actual Secretary of State, or is he going to be off on his own?
Yeah, that's a great question. And then the flip side is an interesting question, too, because Kerry is a former Secretary of State who's going to be sitting on the National Security Council. And what if issues come up related to the Middle East or Russia or China policy? Isn't Kerry going to be weighing in, and will people be looking to him as the former Secretary of State? So that it could create tensions both on the climate front, as Blinken says, hey, why don't I get to weigh in on the Secretary of State? And then on the other issues, as Kerry might feel like he wants to weigh in on everything.
You know, it's kind of interesting, as you make this great comparison in the article, which again comes from your book about Stassen handing in his resignation, and essentially, you know, Dulles won that power struggle, if you will. You know, Stassen was the new and up-and-comer, and in this case, the guy who's been handed a cabinet-level position, or a position that isn't cabinet-level but being given cabinet powers, is the old guard, is, the, as you say, the former Secretary of State who's already got relationships, and in fact, some people may accuse him of violating the Logan Act, which, you know, sometimes gets kicked around now because he has continued to carry on relations with a lot of other foreign leaders. But this is John Kerry. He's the old dog here, and he's got an ego that is outsized even for Washington, D.C. Can you see him taking any orders whatsoever from somebody like Blinken?
Well, I think it's going to be hard, and I do point out the issue that ego is a huge part of this, and Kerry was often voted the most egotistical senator, so I think it's going to be hard for him to step back. Well, on the other side, let me say that everybody does say that Blinken is a nice guy, which could be a good thing, meaning a nice guy is less apt to get in these fights. Or it could be a bad thing. Sometimes the nice guys in these White House fights get stepped on and don't stand up for themselves, and that leads to tension as well.
For the complete conversation with Tevi Troy, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
It's a weird and slippery definition of what's newsworthy and what's not.
The gigantic failure of elite media when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They're preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Mark Davis, in for Hugh Hewitt. Honest observers of media have marveled, sometimes raged, about the shameful bias that we see coming continually from our elite news outlets. Now, bias is nothing new, but in recent days we're seeing something worse, something close to collusion to hide an important story. I'm talking, of course, about the news surrounding Hunter Biden. In the most recent disclosure, he's under a Justice Department investigation. Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson over at The Morning Answer on AM 560 The Answer in Chicago talked to David Harsanyi, author and columnist now with National Review.
You have to applaud the intransigence of the left. They have a very high standard with respect to their own when it comes to something turning into a thing in the area of federal law enforcement.
Or, yeah, I mean, I don't know if people remember, but I think it was a few days before the Post wrote their Hunter Biden piece, first piece. The big story was that the First Lady had complained about putting up Christmas decorations on a secretly recorded tape, which no one could verify, but put on CNN, on, you know, for a 24-hour loop itself before suppressing this story about potentially the front running candidate for the U.S. presidency being involved in kind of shady dealings. So it's a weird and slippery definition of what's newsworthy and what's not.
And with respect to the question of Attorney General Barr's handling of the whole matter, I mean, there's so much we don't know about why he was unable to fulfill his promise that the American people would know what happened 2016 forward before November 3rd. That didn't happen because the Durham investigation hasn't been completed. And we don't necessarily know the full scope of why or where Durham is going. But, I mean, do you see that as a failure?
We need to know more before I can say if he did a good job in that area or not. And generally, I like him. I think he's pretty straightforward. But I do have a bit of a problem with this idea that the American people, that he actively and, you know, ensured that the American people wouldn't hear more about the Hunter Biden investigation. I know that that wouldn't have happened had the roles been reversed as far as the parties go. But moreover, I just don't understand why. I think that's lending favors to people in power. I think also that the American people deserve to know that the family, that there's evidence, not just that the family, but the candidate himself might be involved in shady dealings and that there's an investigation going on. It doesn't mean that anyone's guilty, but this idea that we have to coddle the American voter and that they shouldn't hear certain things or et cetera is really kind of destructive because it lends itself to corruption.
One respect, the American people did know because it was reported by the New York Post and picked up by other outlets, too. Obviously, it was not picked up by the D.C. press corps because they're the comm shop for Biden and the left. But it was out there. It was that we were discussing it prior to the election. There was even the information about subpoenas having been issued in 2018 in stories that were run before the election. And number two, you know, I mean, there is this protocol at Justice to not comment on ongoing investigations. So, and I think there's good reason for that. So you don't slime people that may be a target of an investigation who never turn out to be charged with anything and negatively impact their reputation publicly. If he would have done that, wouldn't he have not been in the same position as Jim Comey and subject to the same criticism?
As I preface that comment, I'm not exactly sure what went on, but I just don't understand why the Sun of the presidential candidate deserves a special treatment where, you know, how far does it extend to the cousins, to, you know, I mean, to the brother, to who? My whole problem with this isn't really the DOJ. It's the media, which would be right, which should be following these stories. They should have, and they do have, sources within the DOJ who would let them know if these investigations existed. They would let them know the question you just asked. They would let them know if that was true. And that's why we have reporters. We don't have, now we have reporters suppressing stories. And I think that, you know, that's the big takeaway here.
You know, you start to really get into something that's much bigger than just trying to line your pockets, like potentially this data leak implicates. And this could be a lot more far ranging than even we think at this point, focused on the Biden family.
Yeah, and it's just, again, it's just so the hypocrisy of the coverage, considering what we went through with Russia, et cetera, the ton more evidence that the Biden family and probably the Biden administration could be compromised by some kind of Chinese. I'm not saying it's true or not, but that could be compromised by the Chinese because they had business dealings with them that there were of Donald Trump, you know, colluding with Russia.
The D.C. press corps that's not focused on this Biden story is focused on another Biden story, and that is whether or not Jill Biden should be called doctor or not.
It drives me crazy. As I tweeted this out, but the only people I call doctor are people who can prescribe me morphine or Dr. J.
Coming up.
I very much, you know, parallel what Attorney General Barr said in that statement at Notre Dame. We're always facing a choice on family life these days.
A great attorney general's two paths, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. I'm Mark Davis. Lots of interesting reaction when the news broke that U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr is resigning effective this coming week. He was both loyal to the president, yet still ended up crossways with Trump in the wake of the election.
He made his announcement with grace, praising President Trump for his accomplishments and thanking him for the opportunity to serve this second time. Barr's not just a good lawyer. He's also well aware of the challenges to marriage and family and the American way of life facing us today. Dan Proft turned to Notre Dame professor Scott Yainer. He's the author of The Recovery of Family Life, Exposing the Limits of Modern Ideology. From AM 560, The Answer in Chicago.
Barr sort of presented the two paths that America can choose, the fork in the road that's before us. And unlike Robert Frost's observation, the choice does make a difference. William Barr, sort of giving a shorthand version of a speech he gave at Notre Dame.
I think we're at a juncture in our history where the United States is going to be true to the unique and magnificently successful principles that undergird our government that has also inspired the most successful countries in the world, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and us, and as well as some others. And whether we're going to stick with those principles that have led to the greatest freedom and to the greatest prosperity and has defended the world against left-wing totalitarianism and Nazism, or we're going to go down the collectivist path that has been the undoing of everyone who's tried it. And it's sad to me that we have reached this juncture where a good portion of the American population has no idea what the founding principles are or cannot intelligently discuss the basic principles of our Republican democracy. And that's sad. I personally think that the public educational system will never be able to correct the damage that has been done over the last couple of decades or more.
And he went on to argue for school choice to finish that point. So just on Barr's sort of two paths before America and how that runs into your piece about our new family regime in America.
Yeah, I mean, it was really kind of amazing to listen to Attorney General Barr there. He's really one of the great stars of the Trump administration, I think. I think America has two paths when it comes to the family, too. We've been undergoing a great revolution in family life over the last two generations. I call it the rolling revolution. It seems like a series of unfinishable changes to marriage and family life, which emphasizes individualism at the expense of marital community, emphasizes rights instead of duties, and emphasizes the sameness of men and women as opposed to the differences. And over the last 50 years, ever more ratcheting changes in family life that are promised by the Biden and Harris administration promised to continue and accelerate. And then on the other hand, there's a view that family is central to human happiness and to democratic self-government. And without parents having children and raising them to honorable adulthood, it's very difficult to imagine people who could grow up to be standing on their own two feet and having the virtues necessary to continue Republican self-government. So I very much, you know, parallel what Attorney General Barr said in that statement at Notre Dame. I think we're always facing a choice on family life these days. Families take their ideas of justice and what is good in part from what the public is like. And in America, we've really emphasized we've always been a country that is dedicated to individualism, but we've always qualified that with some recognition that people have duties to their families and to their children. But over the course of the last two generations, our public principles of justice have come to emphasize what is called individual autonomy, the idea that the only bonds that we can really take on are those that we choose, and we can choose to exit those bonds at any moment. So as our public principles have emphasized individual independence and individual autonomy, we have family life coming to represent or reflect those principles of within their family. So it's more difficult for families to understand even what it would mean to take on a duty or to have a responsibility, because the only principle that people use to understand their family lives is autonomy. There's a great parallel, in other words, between what we think publicly about justice and the way families operate. And as our public principles of justice have emphasized autonomy and individualism, our families have taken on those same principles. And it's difficult to imagine family life and marriage really surviving into the future if those are the principles around which we organize them.
Ross Douthat, the New York Times columnist, of course, wrote a recent piece where he argues that our society's future would be radically different if people simply had as many kids as they desired. And he references an interesting paper from a few years back, Car Seats as Contraception, where two economists argued that car seat requirements delay and deter the arrival of the third child, especially because normal back seats won't hold three car seats. So you basically can't have a third young kid in America unless you upgrade to a minivan. Those requirements may save lives, but they also prevent that third child, in a sense. And he argues our society is not exactly more hostile to children than societies in the past. For example, once an American child is born, her girlhood will be safer from all manner of perils than the childhoods of the 1980s, let alone the farm and factory past. But this protectiveness coexists with a tacit hostility towards merely potential children, children who might exist, children who are imagined when people ask about their ideal family size, but who, for all kinds of reasons, are never conceived or never born. And he argues that we lack sort of a moral framework for talking about this problem of the kids that people want when they conceive ideal family size, but they don't have for reasons economic, cultural, and other.
Yeah, I've always been of the opinion that that's a bit of a red herring, and for the following reason. It's a real question of where people value having children and having a marriage. Like, how much do they prioritize it in their lives? And so though people do say that they would like more children than they have, it's also true that both opinion surveys and I think good observation of how people operate show that they delay marriage. You know, now the average age of first marriage is around 30 for men, 28 for women, and that's up 7 or 8 years from previously. That has nothing to do with car seats. It shows that people are less committed, less willing to enter into a marital community, and therefore, they're less willing to take on the responsibilities that come along with marital communities.
Coming up, the Christmas season is about a celebration of the birth of Jesus. But the best gift ever.
Why, it's me, yours truly, on Rescuing Christmas from the COVID Letdown, when we return with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt.
If you enjoy Town Hall Review, and especially if you're a person of faith, let me invite you to listen to another podcast I know you'll enjoy, The Christian Outlook. This week, a Democratic congressman finds himself in a tricky situation.
China has identified politicians all across the U.S. and, you know, helps them, influences them, corrupts them, infiltrates them, whatever.
Albert Mohler examines the record of Raphael Warnock, the Democrat running for Senate in Georgia.
He is one of the most radical candidates on abortion to run not only in the South, but anywhere in recent American history.
And a look at the Christmas story and how different our modern culture has become over the decades.
Today, you know, we want things instantaneously, and these men and women were waiting, and when you wait on the Lord, you'll never be disappointed.
All that and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Given all that we've been through in 2020, I would not be surprised if a good number of you are lacking a bit of the enthusiasm that usually comes attached to Christmas. Christmas is about family, friends, gift exchanges. All of those things are likely to be reduced, constricted this year. It is 2020. So I reminisced a bit on my own show in DFW this week. We'd have none of these festivities. None of this would even happen without the coming of the Christ child, born in a Bethlehem stable.
I'm in three risk groups, age, weight, and not a member of Antifa. Because if you're Antifa, you're COVID-free. Nobody give you any. You take to the streets with a million. You're all good. So in all seriousness, it's a thing. It's a thought. It's a conversation we're having. And we're hoping, and let's have one of those Texas Christmases. We got a couple of big tables outside we can put on the patio. Got one big table there already. Roll another one out. We got sort of the setup tables and the folding chairs. We could probably do about 10 people and distance everybody really well and stuff like that. And there are all kinds of things that I want to have more people in my house than I'd rather err on the side of more people with some masks and distancing rather than shut it down and not have any people outside the immediate family. I hate the virus and I hate the masks and I'm ready to be done. But I'm all about all of us making the decisions that we want to make, having the freedom to make those decisions, avoiding shutdowns and lockdowns, protecting the sick, and trusting the healthy. But my overall point here, my theme, all of this, the shopping that you can't do in person or don't want to, the people that you can't have over or regrettably don't want to, the loved ones that you can't be with. What is the reason for the season? Is it about shopping? Is it even about getting together with any particular person first and foremost? No, those are the trappings of Christmas and the traditions of Christmas that are so great and give us such you know, earthly joy here in our lives here on the planet. The Christmas season is about a celebration of the birth of Jesus, about the best gift ever from God, the gift of his son. A son who subsequently would sacrifice his life so that our sins can be forgiven. We'll rejoin that concept come Easter. Oh, please let Easter be better this year. Can we maybe get some clearance by Easter? Okay, one thing at a time, one holiday at a time. But for this Christmas, no matter what trips you might not take, no matter how constrained your guest list may be, no matter how, you know, limited your options appear to be, nothing interferes with, dims the passion for, or changes the truth of, the celebration of the birth of Christ.
Hey, thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Richest blessings to you and yours this Christmas. You can always catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks, as always, to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Pichon, Michael Cook, and Alex Perez. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Mark Davis, in for Hugh Hewitt. Merry Christmas.